The 1999 Salt Lake Sandstone Symposium presents Session 211, A Modest Proposal for Sustaining the Word Humorist, a paper by Edgar C. Snow, with comments by Ann Edwards Cannon.
Good morning. Does the seem to be this morning? Or can you, what I'm saying? Oh, sorry. I never know about these things. We'd like to welcome you to this early morning session. If you're not here to hear a modest proposal for sustaining the word humorist, we'd appreciate if you'd leave immediately. You're in the wrong place. We're going to have a good time. My name is Kurt Bench. I always like to point out that it's a pleasure for a bench to chair a session. But Sunstone has made it clear they don't like long introductions, so I will be brief. I'm not on the program other than that. So we'd like to remind you, if you did not have a ticket or a badge to get in, that there will be a stiff fine payable to me. Did not put your ticket in or give it to somebody, please do so. They can't afford gate crashers. We will be finishing at 9:45. We'd like to have some time for questions and answers at the end, so that we can get everybody on the tape, which is being done for each session. We'll repeat the questions, and if you could make them as concise as possible, and I doubt there'll be any speeches here other than the ones who have prepared them. We will begin by hearing from Ed Snow, who is, according to the program, a recovering lawyer. I'm not sure what that means. But in a little note to me, he said that due to sins committed in the pre-existence, I understand you'll be chairing my Sunstone presentation. Now, I'm not sure whose sins he was referring to, his or mine. Both. He has gone to a number of schools. He graduated from BYU. He went to the University of Tennessee School of Law, and as well as the Boston University School of Law, and is a practicing and recovering attorney in Atlanta. I asked him if he was from the South. I went on a mission to the South and had to go to the language training mission for several weeks to learn how to talk Southern, but he doesn't talk like we learned to do down in Alabama. He has published a number of essays and papers in Dialogue, Sunstone. He has written for the AML periodical now called Erie Antum, and as well as the, I believe, the newsletter, a number of other publications, including Farm's Review of Books, and I'm not sure what he reviewed, but I've got to go find that one. He is going to be published, we hope soon, announced as a fall title by Signature Books, but as we both concluded, we don't know fall of which year. It's going to be called Of Curious Workmanship, Musings on Things Mormon. It actually does say it's supposed to be out in 1999 or 2000, so got it narrowed down. After Ed presents his paper, Ann Edwards Cannon will respond. She, as many of you know, is a columnist for the Deseret News and has written a number of books, some award winners, including Amazing Gracie and the Shadow Brothers. Her book that's available from Signature Books is What's a Mother to Do? They are available in the book room for sale and at other fine bookstores throughout the throughout the valley. That may or may not be represented at the symposium here. Anyway, she is a very funny person, and she will respond. So let's go from there.
A few months ago in Elders Quorum, our discussion veered off course onto the topic whether Mormons took themselves too seriously, especially considering some of the pronouncements in the DNC about loud laughter and such. The prospect that Mormons didn't have a sense of humor was not very amusing to us. We pondered the question deeply. Several members of the quorum even flipped desperately through the topical guide and Bible dictionary for answers, but were found wanting. And since no one had a copy of McConkie's Mormon Doctrine, we were left for the moment with a stupor of thought. Then intelligence stroked my mind, whether pure intelligence I'll leave to you, and I asked the following questions to the class. When was the last time anyone had a really good belly laugh during a Catholic Mass? Are Buddhist or Muslim jokes funnier than Mormon jokes? Have you ever seen a copy of a text entitled "The Best Loved Humor of the Jehovah's Witnesses"? How frequently would you chuckle at the droll wit of a Baptist minister while he's literally trying to scare the hell out of you at a revival? Do Pentecostalists ever crack wise in tongues? How many amusing anecdotes are shared during a typical Quaker meeting, even if someone speaks? Now, some of those questions are unfair, and you can beat me up after the paper with your response on that. I'm sure my defensive questions would have given us more comfort had it not been for the weakness evidenced in our religious competition. With a collective sigh, we returned to the topic of the lesson, yet I continued to ponder this issue for quite some time. I would now like to share with you my modest proposal relating to this weighty topic, including a suggestion to establish a Strengthening the Member Sense of Humor Committee to initiate a pilot program for the calling of ward and stake humorists. And I'll come back to these topics very shortly. As I continued to work my way through this problem, knowing I must study it out in my mind first, I decided early on I needed to better understand the fundamentals of humor. So shortly after this quorum meeting, I went over to Barnes & Noble and located the text, "How to Be Funny," by comedian Steve Allen, who invented The Tonight Show. I glanced around to see if anyone was looking, and somewhat embarrassed, I pulled it off the shelf to take a peek. Inside were transcripts of old jokes, sketches, and interviews. His humor was too much pun-ishment for me, but some of them were classic, usually more witty than funny, along the lines of Groucho Marx quips. It even had homework assignments like these: write a joke for Rodney Dangerfield, or using the misinterpretation approach, write a response to the statement, "I want a quick sandwich." I decided to buy the book anyway and waited until no one stood at the purchase counter and meandered up to the clerk nonchalantly with the cover pressed to my chest and the spine toward the ground so no one could read the title. The truth is, I would rather have been seen by the Relief Society president purchasing a book entitled "Supermarital Sex" than Allen's book, "How to Be Funny." Arguably, the worst insult in English is, "You have no sense of humor." And I didn't want to make a public confession. Incidentally, I actually own the Supermarital Sex book, but I planned that purchase and wore a baseball hat and dark glasses and made sure everyone saw my wedding ring. When I got to the cash register, I laid Allen's book upside down, hoping the clerk would just scan the thing and put it in a bag without looking at it. My fear was she would turn it over, and before scanning it, I would be humiliated. I wondered what I could say to soften any sarcastic barbs from her. "It's for my wife," would be easy enough. Come to think of it, that's the excuse I used when I bought the Supermarital Sex book. But I should warn you, watch out when you're typing the title "Supermarital Sex." You don't want to switch the I and the T, since "Supermartial Sex" will make people think you're talking about a Kama Sutra Kung Fu handbook, which I did when I was typing this draft at one point. But anyway, the clerk didn't say anything. Then she took my credit card, which now I realize was a big mistake. This very minute, I'm sure Barnes & Noble is selling my name and address to some specialty publisher for the humor impaired, and I will be harassed by niche telemarketers at home during dinner. The truth is, I didn't even want my wife to see this book by Steve Allen, so I put it behind the toilet, which is a place where she doesn't read. It's a good hiding place. My hopes ran high as I read the foreword by Bill Maher of the Politically Incorrect show, but the rest of Allen's book wasn't that funny, funny being in the eye of the beholder, of course. I do recommend, however, the book's brief discussion of theories of funniness and some standard joke formulas. Surprisingly, Allen, quite the Renaissance man, quoted Plato, Aristotle, and Cicero on humor, but without acknowledgments. And I found that the test of true humorists is that they usually dispense with footnotes. Plato saw humor as the result of our enjoyment, according to Allen, of the misfortune of others, due to a momentary feeling of superiority or gratified vanity that the misfortune did not happen to us. Aristotle pointed toward incongruities that pose neither danger nor pain as the cause of laughter, as well as frustrated expectations. Finally, Cicero is cited as the authority for noting that humor can reveal a streak of meanness, since humor is often at someone else's expense, a mild form of sadism. Allen also suggests that laughter is also the brain's way of showing surprise, and I'd say he's right about that. As a result of further research, I soon discovered the word humor itself was originally a part of our early medical terminology. The four humors, which would be a great rock and roll band name, were black bile, yellow bile, phlegm, and blood, which would be great names for the rock and roll band members. A good-humored person was one who had a balance of these four important elements, while an ill-humored person was imbalanced. Humor, in essence, was and still remains a description of mood. We also use the term humor to describe situations and characters, focusing on perceived incongruities. Wit, on the other hand, was and is a method of sorts, often a way of seeing resemblances and often pronounced incongruities. Wit is often characterized by intense dialogue and may not be humorous. Wit is also historically perceived as a duality. False wit, which merely dazzles, versus the only true and living wit, which enlightens. Humor tends to be exemplified in a looser, commonplace, or vulgar situation, whereas wit is often more intellectual and focused. Humor generally has a soft touch. Wit can bite. I also discovered that humor and wit, like the gospel, are as old as mankind. Humankind, I'm sorry. I'm trying to be politically correct here. Although, and the paper says humankind, I just slipped. Although the cultural context for early texts that might contain humor or wit are often difficult at times to understand. But some examples are readily accessible to the modern reader. For example, I'd like to share some early Mesopotamian wit with you. One of many ancient Near Eastern jokes, surely to be published by Farms someday, as a part of its Nibley series, under the title, Hugh Nibley's Favorite Ancient Near Eastern Jokes and Anecdotes. This Mesopotamian text could also have served as an additional verse to the Mr. Grinch song in The Grinch Who Stole Christmas. Who all knows that song? I'm not going to sing it, okay, but you know the song. At the part where the music stops and the text is spoken, you can transplant the original lyrics with this Mesopotamian witty lyric here. And here it goes. You dog spawn, wolf seed, mongoose stench, hyena whelp, carapaced fox, addle-pated mountain monkey of, and then the music starts again, dun, dun, reasoning nonsensical, da 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 da. It would work very well. Sometimes this stuff translates directly, and you can liken these passages unto ourselves. Now, the Bible itself also appears to start off early with one of many puns. Eve is taken from Adam's rib, and the Hebrew term for rib appears to be a play on the word for stumbling, which foreshadows Eve's role with the forbidden fruit as a Pandora-esque female type. In response, some of my friends have suggested that the first joke in the Bible was actually the creation of man, and then God got serious and created woman. The Bible also has forms of humor and wit other than puns. And while the Bible doesn't say Jesus ever laughed, it clearly presents him as a person who participated in witty banter and enjoyed it. One of my favorite repartees of Jesus is his discussion with the Syro-Phoenician woman at the well. Jesus appears to be charmed by her self-deprecating humorous comment that she not be excluded from his mission to the Jewish people, since even dogs at the table are allowed to eat the crumbs. Now, for the sake of time, I'm going to skip a passage in Judges chapter 3, which is kind of some outhouse-landish humor, some of the broader humor that is present in the Bible, but we're going to run out of time if I read that. I recommend it to you. It's humorous if you have a juvenile sense of humor like I do. In searching the scriptures, I also discover that God laughs, and I suspect he likely has a perfect sense of humor. Psalms 2:4 indicates that he that sitteth in the heavens shall laugh. And of course, we're all familiar with Ecclesiastes, which reminds us there's a time to laugh. Now, although a matter of heated controversy, the Book of Mormon purportedly contains some humor. In fact, I think it's easier to prove the historicity of the Book of Mormon than it is to prove that it has humor in it. Robert J. Matthews has claimed the following passages as humorous, but until someone actually slaps their knee and laughs out loud when they're reading it, I'm afraid the skeptics will not believe. Here today I will play the part of the apologist. In Alma chapter 9, verses 2 through 3, I'll read this. Suppose ye that we shall believe the testimony of one man, although he should preach unto us that the earth should pass away? Now, don't laugh yet. I'll tell you when the funny part is coming. It's a sample of early theological humor. Now, they understood not the words which they spake, for they knew not that the earth should pass away. I'm sorry, I forgot to tell you. That was the time when you were supposed to laugh. You missed that one. Let's try another one that might be easier. Alma chapter 55, verses 31 through 32. The Nephites would not partake of the Lamanites' wine, save they had first given it to some of the Lamanite prisoners. And they were thus cautious that no poison should be administered among them. For if their wine would poison a Lamanite, it would also poison a Nephite. And thus they did try all their liquors. Dry humor indeed. Now let's turn to a final one, Alma 57:10. At length their provisions did arrive, and they were about to enter the city by night. And we, instead of being Lamanites, were Nephites. Therefore, we did take them and their provisions. Now this is a standard misunderstanding scenario, the staple of modern sitcoms, which was not discovered until the development of the I Love Lucy show. So how could Joseph Smith have known about it in 1830? Now, what troubles us, though, moving from the Book of Mormon now to the DNC, and what the Strengthening the Member Sense of Humor Committee will have to consider, are several DNC sections that seem to take the fun out of laughing. Here they are. You know them. And they that have laughed shall see their folly. Not with much laughter, for this is a sin, but with a glad heart and with a cheerful countenance. Cast away your idle thoughts and your excess of laughter far from you. Therefore cease from all your light speeches, from all laughter, from all your lustful desires, from all your pride and light-mindedness, and from all your wicked doings. Now, I am not known as a strict constructionist, and I view these laughter warnings as being tied to specific prohibited acts, suggesting that laughter is inappropriate in that limited context only, usually in ridiculing sacred things or participating in lewd or uncontrollable behavior. And I would recommend to the Humor Committee that to expand these DNC revelations about laughter beyond my limited reading of them seems incongruous with the life of their recipient, Joseph Smith. The anecdotal evidence suggests Joseph was a man who loved to belly laugh. One of Joseph's contemporaries said about him, Joe had a jovial, easy, don't-care way about him. He used to laugh from the crown of his head to the soles of his feet. It shook every bit of flesh in him. In fact, the first known bit of humor in the history of the Restoration occurred during the coming forth of the Book of Mormon. Joseph Smith, as reported by Joseph Knight, displayed some very rough, Will Rogers-esque humor while discussing the golden plates with him. Says Knight about the incident, "So that night we all went to bed, and in the morning I got up and my horse and carriage was gone. But after a while, Joseph came home and turned out the horse. All come into the house for breakfast, but no thing said about where they had been. He had borrowed them to go get the plates. After breakfast, Joseph called me into the other room, and he set his foot on the bed and leaned his head on his hand and says, "Well, I am disappointed." "Well," say I, I'm sorry." "Well," says he, "I am greatly disappointed. It is 10 times better than I expected." Then he went on to tell the length and width and the thickness of the plates, and said he, "They appear to be gold." But he seemed to think more of the glasses or the Urim and Thummim than he did of the plates, for says he, "I can see anything. They are marvelous. Now they are written in characters, and I want them translated." Yes, Joseph's early sense of humor was unpolished, like his many other abilities, a huge rough stone rolling down from a high mountain, becoming more polished by smashing into other rocks on the way down. Although no one would accuse the early Joseph of urbanity, a writer no less than John Greenleaf Whittier called the mature Joseph the Yankee prophet and said Joseph had knocked out for himself a window in the wall of the 19th century whence his rude, bold, good-humored face will peer out upon the generations to come. On at least one occasion, Joseph had to defend his own laughing, tugging, and wrestling with the boys when some humorless members of the church, while tugging at their heavily starched collars, openly wrestled with Joseph's apparent light-mindedness. His defense was the story that we all know about the hunter who would not keep his bow strung at all times, otherwise it would lose its spring. Joseph then likened the hunter's bow unto himself. So that no one will misunderstand me, let me stress that the grip of hilarity, like the grip of wrath, is destructive and can be hard to break. As Venerable Yorgi reminds William, the medieval Sherlock Holmes, in Umberto Eco's novel The Name of the Rose. But Yorgi goes too far, and he says, "Laughter shakes the body, distorts the features of the face, makes man similar to the monkey. He who laughs does not believe in what he laughs at, but neither does he hate it. Therefore, laughing at evil means not preparing oneself to combat it, and laughing at good means denying the power through which good is self-propagating." He must have been reading the DNC. William responds that laughter is a good medicine, like baths, to treat humors and other afflictions of the body, melancholy in particular. It's kind of like a permitted medicinal use of a word of wisdom prohibited item. Yorgi maintains that Jesus never laughed, and William argues that the negative evidence in the New Testament is insufficient. I highly recommend that book, by the way. Humor definitely has a dark side, though, and the Humor Committee will have to deal with that. You may recall in the movie Who Framed Roger Rabbit, the bad guy was berating his cartoon minions and said, "One of these days, you idiots are going to laugh yourselves to death." Inspired by that statement, Eddie Valiant, the hero, makes them laugh their heads off with a series of wacky pratfalls that would have made President Gerald Ford look like an amateur. Roger Rabbit spurs Valiant on by cheering, "That a boy, Eddie, you're killing him. You're slaying him. You're knocking him dead." Humor is often linked to violence, substantiating in part Cicero's theory of humor as a form of sadism. And sometimes this is a little bit too close to home for me. For instance, my 3-year-old cackles whenever he whacks our cats with a wiffle bat. And my 6-year-old laughs with me when we watch an anvil fall on Wile E. Coyote's head. My wife hates violence of any sort in a movie, even if Harrison Ford, Mel Gibson, Daniel Day-Lewis, and Brad Pitt are all co-stars in it. But she giggles whenever I walk into a door, table, support pillar, or other immovable fixture, although she quickly composes herself and says, "Honey, are you okay? Because if you are, that was pretty funny." And on a more universal note, was there ever an America's Funniest Home Videos episode without an obligatory errant golf ball, baseball, or tree slamming into a man's crotch? I don't think so. Roger Rabbit's "you're killing him" remarks are, of course, metaphorical, since we often say someone is dressed to kill or suggest that looks could kill. But it still makes you wonder. I imagine someone died at least once from laughter or choked on their own laughter or at least couldn't stop laughing and had to get medical treatment, the way some people get with hiccups. I've often been afraid that my own father would laugh so hard he would choke to death, since sometimes his hearty laughter turns into a violent coughing. The first time I noticed this was when we watched It's a Mad, 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 Mad World. That's probably too many mads in there. I never can get that straight. On The Late Show one night, especially during the part where Jonathan Winters tears down a gasoline station with his bare hands, chasing two goofy attendants around, throwing tires at them, and throwing the attendants at each other and through the station walls. The movie The In-Laws also nearly killed my dad one evening as we watched one of the many Alan Arkin serpentine incidents, if you know that movie. I thought I was going to have to perform the Heimlich maneuver on him to clear his throat. Sometimes we use humor to belittle at best and cripple at worst the targets of our comedic derision. I confess that I have a mean humor streak running down my back as long as the stripe on an unfortunate cat in a Pepe Le Pew cartoon. And it's all I can do sometimes not to give in to it. My great fear is that in my old age, I'll become Don Rickles, a grimacing, sourpussed heckler. Like adult-onset diabetes, this illness appeared in me all of a sudden when I graduated from law school. I'm sure there's no cause and effect relationship with that. Judging from my youthful sweetness, you'd never have suspected a congenital meanness streak within my soul. My only solace is that, according to Leonard Arrington, Brigham Young had bouts with the same disease. Here's an excerpt from a letter by Brigham Young to a member who had requested her name be removed from church records. Not being able to find the name Elizabeth Green recorded therein, I was saved the necessity of erasing your name therefrom. You may therefore consider that your sins have not been remitted you, and you may consequently enjoy the benefits therefrom. On another occasion, when immaculately dressed John Taylor, then president of the Quorum of the Twelve, walked by a meeting held in Brigham's office, Brigham exclaimed, "Well, if there isn't Prince John." And Elder Taylor was not amused by that occasion. Humor can also be a way to control and manipulate an ugly form of attempted enslavement, somewhat akin to hypnotism. Now, I don't recall Machiavelli or von Clausewitz ever mentioning humor as an extension of politics, but it could be. If war overlaps politics on a Venn diagram, perhaps humor overlaps war, although von Clausewitz, being Prussian, likely never could have come up with that notion on his own. For all I know, the CIA is now training undercover humor operatives, even as we speak, to soften up our enemies at home and abroad. Believe me, I negotiate contracts for a living, so I fully understand the power of humor to break down your opponent. Forget about brainwashing, torture, ESP espionage, or Reagan's Star Wars program. In the next war, we should send Jerry Seinfeld, David Letterman, Rosie O'Donnell, Robert Kirby, Eloise Bell, and Ann Edwards Cannon to the front lines with other humorists and comedians, not to mention our own secret weapon, William Shatner. And you are even effective when you intend to be serious. And don't be surprised if a UN inspection team someday finds Iraqi Scud missiles with fully operational laughing gas warheads. Of course, be forewarned that ingratiating laughter is a time-honored method to turn the tables on your enemy. Perhaps this is the way the world ends, not with a bang, but a snicker. Clearly, one of the many blessings to be derived from the establishment of the Strengthening the Member Sense of Humor Committee would be the production of a manual for ward and stake humorists. I told you I would come back to that. That clearly sets forth the LDS doctrine of humor. The Humor Committee might even entertain the idea of sense of humor as perhaps nearly a gift of the Spirit, with some possessing the gift of laughter, others the gift to make people laugh. Although I fully expect the Humor Committee to reject the doctrines associated with the recent so-called Toronto Blessing. Anyone familiar with that? Okay. The Toronto Blessing was made the news a couple of years ago as a Christian sacred laughter movement, and I'm not making this up. People would go to church just for laughs, literally. In 1994, the Toronto Airport Vineyard Fellowship, and I'm not making the name of that congregation up either, held some very unusual meetings in which the congregation was moved to laugh uncontrollably, as well as shake, rattle, roll, tremble, wail, cry, run in place, jump up and down, bark, and buy products from pyramid marketing companies. This was interpreted as a special dispensation of the Spirit, and is reminiscent of similar manifestations experienced by Mormons in the early Kirtland period and denounced by Joseph Smith. Now, it's clear we're not supposed to act like that, but what I'd like the humor committee to clarify for me is whether I'm allowed, morally speaking, to laugh at people who participate in these activities. I would like to find out that. I'm going to need to skip something else here, too, so that I can get moving. Okay, great. Okay, good. All right. I'd also like to predict the contents of the Humor Committee's manual. It will likely be the mirror image of Deseret Book's new title in its Best Loved series, The Best Loved Humor of the LDS People. How many people own that? Maybe my elders' quorum was right. The Best Loved, maybe it just hasn't been marketed well enough yet. The Best Loved Humor of the LDS People, a volume guaranteed to not produce rambunctious laughter, the shakes, fainting, rattling or rolling, or barking, although that guarantee would not extend to multi-level marketing consumerism. Incidentally, this book and Mormon humor itself was the topic of a New York Times article last week entitled Mormon Humor, Get Serious. And it was actually in the New York Times. Robert Kirby, Eloise Bell, and a couple of people were interviewed. You can go on the website for the New York Times and find that. So maybe it is coming of age. It's not that the Best Loved Humor text is not funny. Some parts are tolerably amusing. The volume is arranged, though, for the convenience of someone researching a talk or lesson in church, and as a result, doesn't really lend itself to the enjoyment of gratuitous humor at your leisure. It's like taping The Late Show with David Letterman and watching it the day afterward in the bright sunshine while eating breakfast. It's just not as funny when you're not bone-tired sitting in the dark. Best Loved Humor should be viewed as a correlated topical guide to ensign-worthy humorous jokes and anecdotes. In fact, the more I think about it, and I'm not accusing anyone of plagiarism, this book looks suspiciously like a collection of amusing anecdotes and jokes that were edited out of William Bennett's The Book of Virtues. Another part of the problem with the best-loved humor of the LDS people is that some of the funniest parts have nothing to do with Mormonism in particular, were not written by Mormons, have likely never been quoted in a Mormon meeting, unless by the editors before compiling them into this book. Now, the editors of this book anticipated my cranky comments by suggesting in the introduction that any such passages will eventually become best loved by the saints. Presumably, through the self-fulfilling prophecy marketing strategy of encouraging people to buy the book and quote the passages in Mormon meetings until they become best loved. And that's a Mormon tradition. Many predictions by Joseph Smith and others, people looked at the prophecy and said, well, we've got to make this thing come true. So the Quorum of the Twelve went back to Missouri one night before they went on a mission and, you know, laid a cornerstone just to make sure that thing came true. And I'm all in favor of that. Finally, one last gripe about best loved humor of the LDS people. I wish I had come up with the idea myself to write this book first. I'm actually a little bit jealous. Now, the Dean of Mormon Humor, Richard Craycroft, has thought about writing... Do you need a tracheotomy? Okay. Well, Richard Craycroft, esteemed professor at BYU, has thought about writing a similar book for many years, an anthology of humorous Mormon writings. And he and I have lately been fantasizing about producing this anthology, and I'm glad to announce we now have a nibble from a publisher. Croft is partial to the title, A Marvelous Work in a Blunder, A Collection of Mormon Humor, while I'm kind of partial to the title, Book of Mormon Humor, even though there's a risk people will think it's a collection of humorous passages from the Book of Mormon. Yet another possible publication, but a much more slender volume. Another volume I'd sincerely like to see is a collection of President Hinckley's refreshing humor, although most of his humor is in the moment, if you notice, and a lot of times you had to be there. But if you were there, it was great. And I'll stick my neck out prophetically and predict someday a future historian will refer to him as prophet, seer, revelator, and humorist. I'd also like to see the humor committee produce a video of wacky outtakes from church commercials. A kind of Mormon bloops, bleeps, and blunders. That could be ordered, of course, from the distribution center. Perhaps the humor committee could even sponsor a Mormonism's Funniest Family Home Evening videos on the Vision Network. Now, this humor manual I keep referring to will, of course, be produced by the humor committee, especially for the ward and stake humorists. And I know you've been waiting for this. Now, what exactly do I mean by the calling of ward or stake humorist? If at BYU, bishops are allowed to call people to serve as ward greeters or orange juice specialists, then I think it's high time for leaders to feel free to start extending the calling of ward and stake humorists, kind of like a Mormon jester of sorts. Just like any other calling, some people would be called because of their talents, others because of perceived deficiencies. Shakespeare's advice in this regard should be heeded. God give them wisdom that have it, and those that are fools, let them use their talents. The ward humorist would be required to attend PEC and sit next to the bishop, and many other meetings as well. Now, I'm not saying we should make light of sacred things, but a few non-blasphemous wisecracks every once in a while might help us out. The idea for the calling of ward humorist came to me while reading the novel The Book of Beb, which is by Frederick Buechner. In this novel, a Cherokee Indian acts out the part of the traditional joking cousin at a funeral. Maybe the humor committee could lay claim to some similar forgotten Nephite Lamanite tradition connected to the Cherokee tradition contained in the lost 116 pages of the Book of Mormon. I'll leave that up to them. They can get somebody to research that at farms or somewhere. In the novel, Leo Beb, a charismatic Protestant preacher, describes the joking cousin's role. A joking cousin's role is to make jokes, but he doesn't make your run-of-the-mill jokes, and he doesn't make them at run-of-the-mill times either. Say there's a marriage being arranged, and the heads of both families are all there, or they're all dressed up to make terms. Or say a man's dying, or just died, and the women have come over to pay their last respects. Maybe a girl gets in trouble, and there's a powwow what to do about finding her a husband. Those are the times when the joking cousin does his stuff. Seems as if the joking cousin is the Indians themselves. Now, this is the minister talking about this. Seems as if the joking cousin is the Indians themselves mocking and blaspheming their own holiest times, so as no one else will. Seems to me like an Indian thinks if he mocks the holiest times he's got, maybe then the evil spirits will be fooled into letting the holy times alone. Later, Beb delivers the eulogy at a funeral in which John Turtle, the deceased family's appointed joking cousin, attends. "I am the resurrection and the life," Beb said from the pulpit, and John Turtle stood behind him, holding two fingers up over his head like rabbit's ears. When Beb was winding up his eulogy of the deceased, John Turtle picked his nose on the chancel steps. And during one of the hymns, he ate a slice of watermelon. When he finished it, he made the motions of turning a crank in his neck, which made his head tilt slowly backward like an anti-aircraft gun. When he reached maximum elevation, he turned another crank to make his head swivel around toward the congregation. With his lips puckered out to a point and his cheeks puffed, he waited until the amen came and then pulled one ear to fire. Watermelon seeds flew out like shrapnel to the front pews. Now, okay, on second thought, Mormons should not try this at church. Well, in any event, not in your home ward. The ward humorist would also be responsible to provide resources for ward members to make talks, lessons, and meetings more amusing. Of course, the stake humorist would conduct training meetings every quarter for the ward humorists and provide humor for stake-level activities. Perhaps the stake humorist could orchestrate a stake-wide program providing for laugh tracks during high counselor talks. The ward and stake humorists would also be responsible for interacting on the local level with the media and conducting PR initiatives. A recent episode in Minnesota, for instance, could have used the assistance of an inspired stake humorist. Roy Blunt, a Southern humorist, recently wrote an essay about humor, and he inserted a baptism joke, which he did once on the radio show, A Prairie Home Companion. And here's the joke between two good old boys. Ralph, do you believe in infant baptism? Fred, believe in it? Hell, I've seen it done. This joke set off a chain of emails on the Prairie Home Companion website from members of several different denominations, including a Minnesota Mormon, no doubt a member of the Lake Wobegon Ward. The Mormon listener responded as follows, and this is in the email that she sent or he sent. This Minnesota Mormon, Mormons don't believe in infant baptism either, thought that the joke was very funny. Mormons also believe in baptism by immersion, not sprinkling, and in baptism for the dead, by proxy, that is, don't flip out. Hence the Mormon joke. Did you hear that the Catholics have started practicing nepotism for the dead? Yeah, they just installed a new lawn sprinkler in their cemetery. Now, Mr. Blunt reported that the Minnesota Mormon concluded by saying, an outsider would not get this joke. Mr. Blunt then warned the reader of his essay, we can't, of course, generalize from this statement that all Mormons pride themselves on their own humor's obscurity. Now, if I had been the stake humorist in Minnesota, for instance, I would have diffused this delicate controversy by issuing a simple and short press release along the following lines. In order to fully understand this Mormon joke, you really need to talk with some missionaries from the church who would be more than happy to explain it to you. But at the risk of giving you a simplistic answer, you should note that baptism sounds a lot like nepotism, a Catholic historical practice, but not peculiar to Catholics. In fact, the early Mormon practice of adoption, for instance, you could be adopted as a son of Brigham Young or Joseph Smith until that was discontinued. This early Mormon practice of adoption was the true doctrine of nepotism for the dead. The only guidelines for such press releases should be to be careful not to explain humor too much. Dissection usually kills its subjects. And now I'm winding up here. Since Orson Scott Card's Saint Speak is no longer in print, the Humor Committee could also be in charge of preparing a pamphlet to assist non-Mormons attending our meetings to help them better understand our humor. It's kind of an extension of the missionary program. Here are some sample entries for such a glossary of Mormon terms. DNC has nothing to do with an OBGYN, but is an abbreviation for a collection of Joseph Smith's revelations. MIA has nothing to do with anyone missing in action, but see, for instance, the terms inactive and less active. Instead, it refers to one of the many names given to Mormon youth organizations. And finally, Searstone is a pre-IBM Apple handheld personal data assistant. PDA, not to be confused with public display of affection. See activities prohibited at BYU. This implement is made from natural substances. Keeler says that God writes a lot of comedy. The trouble is he's stuck with so many bad actors who don't know how to play the scenes. Ward and stake humorists would magnify their callings by giving the saints the necessary acting lessons. Ward and stake humorists would also preach a doctrine taught by Brigham Young and no doubt believed by President Hinckley himself. I sometimes think God must enjoy humor and that he won't be strict in reckoning with a humorist. Amen, Brother Brigham, amen. And like Moses, Ward and stake humorists would also have the following motto: would God that all the Lord's people were humorists and that the Lord would put his sense of humor in them. Thanks.
My maternal grandfather, David Irwin Covey, wore many hats during his incredibly long life, most of which was spent in the wilds of Wyoming. He was at one time or another a cowhand, college student, mechanic, school bus driver, truck driver, mail carrier, arrowhead and artifact collector, rum runner, gas station owner, dance band saxophonist, son, husband, father, Freemason, and, in the later years of his life, Mormon. The hat he most preferred wearing, and the one he wore most consistently, however, was that of humorist. With his sharp eye for human frailty and his laid-back, laconic delivery, my grandfather was our family's answer to Will Rogers. I know he would have enjoyed your paper as much as I did, Ed. He would have appreciated your analysis of what humor is without managing to kill it. E.B. White once made the observation that humor can be dissected, as a frog can, but the thing dies in the process, and the innards are discouraging to any but the pure scientific mind. Congratulations, Ed, for leaving us with the living frog. My grandfather would have also enjoyed your examples of humor drawn from such diverse sources as scripture and cinema, as well as your own experience. I know he would have particularly loved to read Hugh Nibley's favorite ancient Near Eastern jokes and anecdotes. Like you, he was always a big fan, in your words, of early Mesopotamian wit. As for me, I particularly enjoyed your account of buying a book with the title like How to Be Funny. It reminded me of that time in junior high school when I checked out a book from the library called How to Be Popular. It didn't work. I still experience the same social humiliation when I buy trashy romances with covers featuring women with big, billowing bosoms and guys who look like Fabio before the goose attacked him. So, I could relate. You hand a book over like this to the cashier and you just watch your IQ drop by about 20 points in their eyes. What my grandfather would have liked best about your paper, however, was the proposal itself, that we indeed call and sustain humorous on the warden's stake levels. He would have been the first one to raise his arm to the square. As Richard Craycroft has so eloquently pointed out, Mormons need to laugh. Laughter relieves the incredible pressures that come from living in an authoritarian culture that emphasizes and encourages the attainment of individual perfection. The word humorist, of course, would be incredibly useful in this respect. Let me say right now, however, that the word humorist would certainly be one of the easiest jobs in the ward, not unlike that of greeter. This is because, in my experience, Mormons not only need to laugh, they want to laugh. The word humorist wouldn't need an opening act. He'd find his audiences come to church already warmed up. I was thinking about our willingness, our eagerness to be amused when I was sitting through my aunt's funeral a while ago. My cousin told a wonderful story about his mother, who was certainly everything a Mormon woman of her generation was supposed to be. Apparently, when he was a little boy, my cousin was out working in the garage with his father, my uncle, when he accidentally hammered his thumb. Well, my cousin... Okay, just a sec. I don't know why I'm nervous. Well, my cousin just let loose with a very long stream of particularly fresh and inventive obscenities. My uncle listened, took a deep breath, then calmly and gently said, "Son, I don't ever want to hear you talk like that again. That brand of the King's English is reserved for your mother's exclusive use." It occurred to me as I listened to this terrific story that Mormons like to laugh because we, perhaps better than most people, are aware of the tension between the ideal and the real, the way things ought to be and the way that things really are. And it is this very incongruity, as Aristotle noted, which gives birth to humor. Now, back to my grandfather. I was fortunate enough to be with him the night he died. As we sat around his bedside, wondering what to say to someone with whom you know you will not speak again in this lifetime, we started to tell funny stories. This may seem odd and inappropriate, and yet it was the very perfect thing to do, because over the years my grandfather had given us 1,001 funny tales, just like Scheherazade, and now we were giving some of them back to him to accompany him on his new journey. And you know, it did occur to me, as I sat there that night, that this, in fact, is how I want to die, to the sound of the people I love laughing. Thank you.
Does this okay? It does work. We have several minutes for questions and answers. So, if you'd like to ask a question of either, why don't you come up? I can share that. Any questions? Now, come on. We left several minutes on purpose. Can you summarize that first?
That question. Arthur Henry King once said that humor is a great way to combat evil, which seems slightly contradictory to your gaze comments that if you laugh at evil, you don't take it seriously in the novel The Name of the Rose. Is that right? Okay, next. I think it all depends on the person. I think... for me, things that are truly evil, the Holocaust, you name things that are truly evil, those things are hard to joke about, and you know the Challenger crashing. And yet, within a week of those events occurring, there are these jokes that go around that people tell at the office or at school. And I've always been astounded at how people can tell these jokes and how we laugh at them. And laughter, it serves so many functions. And in those situations, I think it allows us to blow off some steam. Every tragedy that Shakespeare wrote had comedy relief in it. And I think that comedy has to be there. And I think Jorgi's wrong. I think that laughter is necessary. And in fact, you'll note that in the Farm's review of books, a lot of times there are some very funny, if you agree with their position, articles, because they do often use some humor. Sometimes it's a little bit mean-spirited, too. But if you're on their side, it's very funny. Now, having said that, Frederick Buechner, who's one of my favorite novelists, who's a Protestant minister, he wrote a three-volume memoir that I highly recommend. The first one's called The Sacred Journey. And he was a novelist first and then became a minister later and studied theology. And he indicated that he dropped in by accident one day at a sermon in New York City, was not really a believer, had been raised Christian, but didn't really care about it. He was sitting in the back row, and he heard the minister say that Christ is crowned king in the hearts of believers everywhere in the midst of tears, confession, and great laughter. And he woke up, and that converted him to Christianity. And if you read, his novels have been compared to Flannery O'Connor, which combine both some of the most tragic things you can think of, some of the most evil things you can think of, and sprinkled with humor, which is, you know, exactly what life is. So I think I would agree with Arthur Henry King on that, and I wish that William had known about that in the novel. He could have used that. One quick note, the University of Illinois Press is publishing a text on Jay Golden, which is, you know, Cheney did that volume a long time ago that BYU printed and got in trouble for printing, and he had to publish it elsewhere. Illinois Press is going to come up with, and I forget who has compiled it, he's a professor at BYU, but there will be a rich source of Jay Golden Kimmel's stories. I think we're the ones who have to carry that on now. I mean, you know, President Hinckley does a good job with a lot of self-deprecating gentle humor, but you know, I would like to see that in my lifetime. Maybe Ann Edwards Cannon will be ordained someday to an office and may be able to do that.
You know, I think that you still have characters like that on the local level, if you're lucky. I mean, I think that sometimes that is where that kind of character can show up. Because one of the wonderful things to me about award situation is that you become involved with each other and very often tolerant of one another in ways that sometimes we're just not allowed to as a large institutional church. And so I think that those kinds of things can still happen there. We've got a lot of that in my own quirky avenues ward, and it's one of the reasons I love it so much. But not on the, I don't think we'll see it over television. I am.
Also, you have the Correlation Committee. You have, it's broadcast everywhere. Jay Golden is still, when people would listen to sermons for 2 hours, for entertainment. And I think there's a lot of that there. That they were more for
doing. He was local.
Yeah, local.
Maybe Paul Dunn was the last one that dared.
I was just wondering if the word humorous would require a pet word.
Repeat it.
Of course. The question is whether the word humorist for that calling would require a temple recommend. And I say yes.
Any others? One parting note before you go out to buy and plan to buy Ed's when it comes out. The nice thing about if this position is never officially adopted, it is one that you can call yourself to and you don't have to be sustained.
You can aspire to this call.
You can aspire to it. Thank you very much for coming.